Well, good morning, guys. It's Monday as this one's coming out. And normally on Mondays, we've been doing this podcast called The Monday Minute. It's usually Steve and I just kind of catching up and talking about whatever's timely or relevant or what have you. Steve's out. He's out hunting. He has a special deer tag that he's filling probably this morning. Knowing him, he's tagged out on his first day of hunting quite a few years over the past recent years. We'll see if that happens again this year. This is going to be a full show, not just a Monday Minute, but kind of in the vein of a Monday Minute. I wanted to take a few minutes just to give you guys several important updates. And this is stuff about the future of the podcast, not long term, but over the next, 4 to 6 weeks, things like that, as well as some updates from recent past. So first of all, recent past, we had that In My Exo giveaway. Thank you to all of you guys who participated. It was incredibly fun to see your posts on Instagram, your videos on YouTube, to see how you are using your pack, Exo or not, and to see what gear you guys are carrying into this season. So it was cool for us to see that. I know that the community got a lot of value out of that as well. The winners have been announced and contacted directly. So if you haven't been contacted, unfortunately didn't win. And then also we did announce those publicly over on the Hunt Back Country Instagram page. So if you want a recap of that, you can go check out the winners there. In the next week, we are going to be releasing an episode every day this week. So it's Monday. This is going to be a full-length episode today about acute mountain sickness, a topic that's important to consider, especially if you know, are going to obviously to hunt at elevation, and particularly if you haven't spent a lot of time or don't regularly spend time at elevation. So this is going to help you understand what acute mountain sickness is, how to diagnose it, how to prevent it, how to treat it, all of that good stuff. That's today's show. Instead of releasing an episode once a week, which we've been doing for a couple years now, September is just too crazy busy to do that. We'll be out hunting. Many of you will be out hunting. So to make up for us not posting through September, we're just going to release a bunch of episodes this week, bunch of full length episodes. So this is going to be great. If you want to space them out and listen to them through September, that's going to be perfect. If you have a big, trip, a bunch of time in the car to and from hunts, have more than just one episode to kind of tune into if you'd like to do that. So this week, a bunch of good stuff. Again, acute mountain sickness today. We have another podcast specifically just about weather. We have a podcast on the differences between Roosevelt and Rocky Mountain elk and kind of how to hunt those species. A podcast that's really helpful for beginners. If you're new to learning Western hunting or how to hunt elk, we talked with someone who did it on his first hunt last year and kind of his story and the lessons learned. And then we talk with a gentleman who's just an under the radar, meaning he's not out on social, is not trying to make a name for himself, but he's just a flat out amazing hunter. Super quiet guy, reserved guy. We kind of had to get him on the show and pull some things out of him, but so much good information from him and the experiences he's had in the field. And then the lessons that he's learned through, the family, which you'll hear about. So anyway, whole bunch of good content coming out this week. So stay tuned for that. Wanted to thank you guys as well, as we typically do for the feedback that we get. We really do appreciate it. We love hearing from you guys, both positive and negative about the show. We're always looking to improve. And then it's just fun to hear how the show has helped you guys. So first of all, Ben Bennett, thank you for leaving a review in iTunes. We want to send you some swag. So send us your shipping address. Just email us podcast@exomountaingear.com. And listeners, as always, you can enter for these little giveaways. Just leave us your feedback, whether that's direct, you can email us, or you want to leave a review in iTunes or Stitcher, wherever else you're listening to this, that'd be great. But we value that feedback. We want to make the show better. And so we need you guys to help us do that. So anyway, Ben Bennett, email us podcast@exomountaingear.com. We'll get you set up. Also, speaking of hearing from you guys, the listeners, as you head into this season and have some adventures and some stories and hopefully some photos to share, things like that, reach out. We'd love to hear how it goes for you guys, whether that's, celebrating in a successful hunt or, just kind of sharing some of the lessons learned and experiences that you had in the field. It would be cool to interact with you guys on that. And speaking of success, that's a word we throw around a lot, and we talk about a successful hunt. And typically when we say that, we're talking about a filled tag, right? But as we all know, and as the odds are, success isn't guaranteed, and success won't happen for even the majority of us, really, in terms of a punch tag. But it was interesting. I was reading some things this past week, and Coach John Wooden, who's, you know, a great mind in terms of leadership and has so many insights to share, he defines success as peace of mind. And you can go look up this quote, but what he's really getting at is success is peace of mind and knowing that you did your best. It's knowing that you gave all you had. And so success in terms of hunting shouldn't be just, did I fill a tag or didn't I? Success should be, did I give it what I have? Did I do my best? Did I try? Did I get out there? Did I take the risk? Did I put in the effort? Did I put in the preparation? Did I make the most of the opportunity that I had? Because as we talk about in hunting, you can't control things like weather. You can't control the pressure. You can't control the timing, maybe in terms of the animals. There's so many things we can't control, but success should be just the peace of mind of knowing that we did our best. So I wish you guys all a successful season this year. And by success, yes, I hope you punch some tags, but by success, I mean, just go out there, give it your best, do your best, enjoy the whole experience, have fun, be thankful for it. It's amazing to think about how lucky we truly are to be able to go out and chase these wild animals, and in particular on public land, and have these great adventures and do these amazing things, that we have the physical ability to do that, that we have the resources, you know, to take some time away from work and from life and from all that chaos and go and make these memories. So you guys, I just want to encourage you all to cherish it, enjoy it, have fun. All right, enough rambling for me. Let's finally get into this episode. I'm sorry for the long intro, but just wanted to share all of that and kind of take care of some house cleaning, and I'll let you guys know what the next several weeks were looking like for us and for the podcast. So our guest on this episode is Robert Roach. He is the director of the Altitude Research Center at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. So his job literally is to research and understand the effects of altitude. And we speak with him about altitude sickness or acute mountain sickness. We get into understanding what is happening in the body, how to prevent it, how to treat it, how to diagnose it, how to understand if you truly have, you know, acute mountain sickness, or if you're just, you know, feeling some sort of side effects and things like that. So hope you guys enjoy this one, learn from it. Thank you so much for tuning in. Let's get right into it. Well, Robert, welcome to the Hunt Backcountry podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Steve, how you doing, man?
I'm good, man. I'm super, super excited for this podcast. I think altitude sickness is something that, or just dealing with altitude is definitely something that pops up. I think fortunate enough living in Boise that when I spend time at 9,000-10,000 feet, I haven't personally had issues, but definitely have friends that come from the Oregon coast, come out here. I mean, just on the death hike that we just wrapped up, you know, we had some guys who were getting dizzy, getting headaches. You yourself got pretty good headache that one, going over that pass. So yeah, it's super, I have zero understanding and knowledge of what's going on and the physiology behind it. So super excited to talk to Robert here.
Yeah. Robert, just to get the ball rolling, can you go ahead and give us some context, background, personally, professionally, anything that applies to why we're speaking with you today about this topic?
Sure. I've been interested since I was a young man in college, which was a while ago, in how people adjust to high altitude. And I started climbing on Mount Rainier. I went to college in Washington State. And, you know, I noticed I got a headache, and Rainier's unique. It's like a lot of your travelers that Steve was talking about, where you can go from sea level in Seattle to the top of Rainier in 12 hours. And that's a big change, 14,000 plus feet. And I, you know, I'd see people who were just tough as nails, boys and girls, it didn't matter, at low altitude. and then they'd get up to 10,000, 11,000 feet, and they didn't feel so good. They weren't so strong. They couldn't go on. And I just thought it was fascinating, because then you turn around and they'd be crabby and feeling terrible and start heading down, and a couple thousand feet down, and they felt great, and they were back to themselves and full of energy, and sometimes wanted to go back up, which I always thought was funny. But so that got me interested as an undergrad. We got our first grant there in the late 70s to study mountain sickness, and I've been going at it ever since. You know, we now do very sophisticated and expensive studies, still trying to figure out everything that there is about mountain sickness and how to prevent it and how to treat it. And so I'm real happy anytime there's a group of users like your group that's interested in knowing more about it.
Yeah, that's awesome. We certainly appreciate you taking the time to help us understand it, for sure. Just to get the conversation started and begin to understand the topic, I think altitude sickness is somewhat of a broad term, and then under that sort of informal umbrella, I know that there's very specific scientific terms for things like acute mountain sickness, and then getting into things like high-altitude cerebral edema and high-altitude pulmonary edema. Help us understand, under this umbrella term of altitude sickness, the specific, I guess, technical classifications of what one might experience, because I know that there's some differences among those.
Sure. So I'd even start out one step before that, and there's high-altitude headache. And so you guys talked about having experienced headaches, and you can get a headache. It's really common. And the headache can be a mild headache that goes away after you get up after a night's sleep, or it can be a headache that lasts and really is debilitating and prevents you from doing what you want to do. And then there's mountain sickness, which includes headache plus feeling nauseous, maybe vomiting, shortness of breath, dizziness. And then so that those things together are called acute mountain sickness. And then there's high-altitude pulmonary edema, and that's water in your lungs. And there's cerebral edema, and that's water in your brain. Both of those are serious. They're luckily rare. So there's about a 1 to 3% chance of at 14,000 feet of getting high-altitude pulmonary edema, and less than 1% risk of getting cerebral edema. Those risks change depending on how fast you go to high altitude and depending on your individual susceptibility and how long you stay at that altitude. We more often see cerebral edema at higher altitudes. Pulmonary edema, though, is common at, I know best, I live in Colorado, I work with the doctors that work in Summit County, and Summit County is where Breckenridge, Keystone, Arapahoe Basin are located. And at those altitudes where people, where tourists are sleeping at 8 to 10,000 feet, there are hundreds of people a year, there are millions of visitors, but there are hundreds of people of those millions of visitors that get high-altitude pulmonary edema. You don't want to get high-altitude pulmonary edema, and if you do get it, you want to know what to do about it, because it can kill you. Acute mountain sickness is not like that. It can't kill you by itself. It has to turn into problems like HAPE, the high-altitude pulmonary edema, or HACE, the high-altitude cerebral edema, to be a threat to life.
Okay. So let's start with...
that lay out how the things fit together?
Yeah, that's helpful. Let's start with just acute mountain sickness, kind of the more common, less dangerous of the different diagnoses. And what's happening in the body? So when we talk about, you know, headaches and nauseousness, maybe some dizziness, things like that, really what's happening within us that is causing these symptoms?
We know a lot, but we don't know everything. And what we do know is that it's something in the brain is going haywire. It isn't adjusting. And just so you don't think that we're particularly dumb in this field of research, we don't really know what causes most headaches. We know some things about different types of headaches. And we know about high altitude headache that it is caused by the low oxygen. It may be caused by changes in the blood volume in the brain and technical stuff like that. But basically it's, you know, about, let's see, at 8,000 feet, about 25% of people that go to 8,000 feet from sea level will get a headache. At 12,000 feet, about 50%, maybe more. And at 14,000 feet, 60 to 80% of people will get a headache. It feels like it's pulsing, which was one of the first hints that it might have to do with the blood volume in your brain and the kind of pulsatility of that, you know, beat by beat blood going into the head. But why that happens, we really don't know. We know that if you gradually go to high altitude, it's your listeners will be surprised to learn that if you spend one night in Denver on your way to Vail or, you know, that area in Summit County at 8,000 or 10,000 feet, if you spend one night in Denver, you basically cut in half your risk of getting mountain sickness. And that's a process. Probably the question you haven't asked yet is about this process called acclimatization. When you acclimatize, you don't get mountain sickness. You're over it and you're kind of protected from it. And right now our research is about how to figure out what it is that happens when you acclimatize that kind of gives you this shield of protection.
That's interesting, Robert. So what you were saying about, you know, spending that night in Denver is basically what I've been doing for quite a few years. So I'm from Missouri. The guy that I hunt with a good amount is from Illinois. And so we drive out from the Midwest and hunt Colorado quite a bit. And we'll typically spend a night, it's in a town past Denver, but it's around 9,000 feet. And just spending that one night there in a hotel before we then finish the drive and then pack in for a hunt the next day is actually doing us a lot of good, huh?
Absolutely. And it would, and driving is doing you a lot of good too. You know, the we can do everything faster and, you know, better, quicker, and worse in terms of acclimatization. You know, these old guys, I'm not talking about hunting, but about mountaineering. These old guys, and I'm talking old, you know, in the 30s, when they were going to the Himalayas, it was, first of all, a multi-month ship journey, and then weeks to get to 10,000 feet. And their experiences with mountain sickness were really limited. You had to find some place where the sea was close to the mountains and you could get up high. And a lot of the inner Himalaya wasn't like that. And you know, by wagon train from St. Louis to the Rocky Mountains, heck, you were at 5,000 feet for days, then 6,000 feet, 7,000 feet. And so that concept is important for your readers to know. And that is that the faster you go, the more risk you're at. Certainly, you know, flying to Denver isn't a risky thing, though the Denver airport has more reports of fainting of any airport in North America, which is kind of interesting. So there is something going on. But, the slower you can go, and I know that everybody, you know, is there, if they're not looking at their watch, they're looking at their calendar and trying to figure out how to squeeze one more day of the fun stuff into a tight vacation schedule, work schedule, you know, family schedule. And there's a lot of pressure to go fast, but there is nothing yet. I'm working on it. I promise you, I'm working the day in and day out on how to speed up the process. But right now we don't know how to do that. And there's nothing like time. And so that one night is absolutely great. And, you know, as you get older, if you maybe you're a little more sensitive to the altitude, and there's not proof that it's really worse when you're older. Maybe we just get smarter and like to punish ourselves less. But as you do this year after year, you may find that two nights at that 9,000 foot place are even better. And I guarantee you, from a physiology point of view, two nights at 9,000 feet will be better than one night, and it will benefit your later altitude exposure experiences.
Yeah. I would imagine, too, not only the rate of gain, so thinking of, like, you know, what you mentioned of taking a wagon versus driving versus flying, so basically how quick are you just immediately exposing yourself to altitude? I'm also curious about, while at altitude, the rate of your exertion. So, you know, how physically active are you? I'm sure that that would play a role in how susceptible you are to developing some sort of sickness. Is that correct?
Yes, it is correct, but it's especially correct early in your exposure.
Okay.
So I'll give you an example. We did an experiment where we took a bunch of young research subjects and scientists to 17,000 feet in Bolivia. And we had a lab that was on one part of the mountain, and the eating and living area was on the other part. And there was a road between them about a half a mile long, and it went downhill slightly and then back uphill. And when we first got there, everybody, all the lab scientists, would take their cameras when they were walking from the lab to the eating place. And they take their cameras because then they had an excuse to stop about every 100 feet and catch their breath. And they'd be standing there so out of breath, they almost couldn't take the picture. But they'd take a picture and look around. Oh, isn't this beautiful? Within 2 weeks of being at that same altitude, and 17,000 feet is very high. It's a tough place to be. Within 2 weeks, they were walking that nonstop. Nobody was taking pictures anymore because they'd both seen the view, but they also had the endurance that improved about 10% over those 2 weeks. And that made the difference between just really being stretched to work out at all at the beginning and being able to walk that half mile at one go. And so that's acclimatization. And you're not acclimatized when you first get to a new altitude, but you get acclimatized over a few days. At 9,000 feet, 2 or 3 days, you're much better shape to do exercise, and that exercise is going to cost you, your body, much less than you are on the first day, for example.
Yeah.
Is it, are some people just susceptible to it? Like, do they not have the ability to acclimatize?
There are some people that should be, the way we say that is, there are some people that should be surfers.
Again, you're just going to get it. And, even if you're up there for 2 weeks and you do everything right, you're still going to get it no matter what.
We had a guy that worked for us, Steve, on Mount McKinley years ago, a young doctor, and he was a nice guy and really smart. He spent the entire 2 weeks where he was supposed to be seeing altitude cases and you know, helping us out and doing all this stuff. He spent the entire 2 weeks, we would set a cot up for him outside. And so he could get out of his tent, take care of business, and then get back in his sleeping bag on the cot and lay there all day long because he felt so terrible. But that was one of hundreds, and that's rare.
Yeah.
But there's, on the other end too, there's the son of a gun that you might know that you go on a trip with, and everybody but him or her feels terrible. And this person is unfazed, totally untouched by the altitude. And they're those too. And then the rest of us are stuck in the middle where, you know, I still get headaches when I go to altitude. I study altitude sickness because I'd sure like to, you know, have it so people don't have to do this, experience what I've experienced in the past. But, you know, I know ways to do it better and be safer about it. But absolutely, we talk just like there, you know, there's a doe that's a year old, you know, there's a huge variation in size, and it depends on their life experience for the last year and their genetics. It's the same with, and so that's what we call in biology a bell-shaped curve. And almost everything we talk about, even for high-altitude pulmonary edema, there's some people that are at high risk. And there's some tests we can actually do in the lab for those people. And then and there are some people that could have exactly the same exposure and not get sick at all. And so it's definitely variable. And anybody, one thing I've learned from the special forces, and I hope they've learned from me, is those are some of the toughest guys around, and they work out like you can't believe. They're very strong. They're not muscle bound as much as they are kind of a marathon runner that can carry a 100-pound pack. I mean, they're a real unusual animal. And they really learned that even the most tough guy and most macho guy in their group might get just knocked down by high altitude illness. It has nothing to do with how fit you are at sea level. It has nothing to do with, you know, how tough you talk. It's what we call the great equalizer at altitude, and puts everybody kind of on the same playing field.
So, out of curiosity, I was going to say, if you were talking about just the density of the air there earlier on, like if you put somebody in an air chamber at sea level and took, do you have the ability to take air out of the room to where the oxygen level is at 60% or whatever it would be? And are you getting the same results?
Here's a nerdy fact for you. So at the top of Mount Everest, there is, guess what percent of oxygen is in the air?
I have no, I'm going to say 50%.
30.
Well, it's 21% at sea level.
Oh, well, we're way off, Steve. We suck.
Oh, I assumed it was 100% at sea level.
So, we're really
so
smart.
What's interesting is there's still 21% on the top of Mount Everest.
What?
So the percent, yes, but hold on, the percent of oxygen doesn't change. What changes, and you know this, you just haven't put the two things together, is the pressure. There's a third of the pressure in the atmosphere. And what's freaky about altitude is you can't see it, right? It's a mystery. If you go... You know, I'd love to stand on a Colorado mountain and you look out over everything and you can't see the reason why you're breathing hard. Right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that makes it a mystery. And that's why everybody doesn't know about it. It isn't like looking at water and knowing the risks of drowning and knowing what it does to you. That's pretty easy to conceive. But what changes is the pressure. So there's a third less pressure on the top of Everest pushing that air, the 21%, into your lungs. And that is what makes a difference. And that's what we can do if we have a pressure chamber. I alter the pressure. We do that almost every day in the lab. And we can go to, in 10 minutes, we can be at 16,000 feet and sit there all day doing an experiment with somebody sitting at 16,000 or exercising at 16,000 feet. So yes, it's absolutely possible to mimic this in the laboratory.
So when you talked about the probability of people being affected by this, is the research looking at certain things like certain genes or certain sequences that might be an indicator as to who's more susceptible to altitude sickness?
So what we think about genetic kind of predisposition is that it's probably the genetics of how we respond to the challenge instead of some single gene underlying, you know, if you have this gene, you're going to get Alzheimer's disease. There, we haven't identified a single gene that would give you a headache. It hasn't been done in the headache field either. What is emerging as the pattern is that there are a number of genes and it kind of depends on how you react. So this is kind of some heavy science, but there's a molecule only discovered a few years ago called hypoxia inducible factor. And you can think about that as the little guy sitting in your cells monitoring how much oxygen's in your blood. And when it notices that the oxygen level gets low, it basically pulls the fire alarm and says, emergency, emergency, oxygen levels are getting low. We need to mount this response. And I have the program here to turn on thousands of genes or to turn them off if they're dangerous. And that's what acclimatization is. We know that for pretty sure. Is this turning off and turning on different genes in a sequence regulated probably by this thing called hypoxia-inducible factor And like Steve asked before, you know, is there variation in people? Well, when you're talking about thousands of genes and the program for those, obviously there's going to be a huge amount of variability. And that may be the basis of why we all react in different ways. But it's so important for the body to not let us have low oxygen, because the body knows from evolution that we'll die if we have too low of a level of oxygen. You probably saw it in the news over the last week. I, like everybody else, couldn't stop watching about these cave kids in Thailand. And they were, you know, an unintended consequence of all of a sudden having all the rescuers come in there was all of a sudden there are a lot more people in a room that has no fresh air supply, and the oxygen levels started going down. I don't think it ever got really low. I mean, it got like Summit County low. And so in addition to everything else, these kids had to put up with slowly adjusting to high altitude. But, you know, thanks be to those incredible rescuers that they, it looks like everybody, as I read this morning, but the coach is out and they're all going to be fine. But that risk of hypoxia is something we're very, very sensitive to. And it's run by genetic kind of sensing systems in our body, and unraveling those and figuring out how to use medicines to change how those genes react is kind of the core of what we do in our research right now.
It's fascinating. So,
Those kids in the cave, you said that the oxygen's getting low. So that's the opposite almost of, it's not air pressure. It truly is the oxygen level in the air, but it has the same effect as the pressure getting low at high altitude.
That's right. So it's in this room that has no fresh air. And so then you have to think of it as a finite resource. It's no different than water or anything else that you use. You breathe in 21% oxygen, you exhale about 16%. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out, you know, that 5% difference. If you got 100 people doing that, you're going to use up your supply pretty quick.
Just thinking of folks who might be listening to this and wondering about, you know, are they prone? Maybe they haven't had much altitude exposure yet, but they're planning a trip, something like that. Are there other factors that might make someone more susceptible? I'm thinking of things like, clearly you have asthma, something like that. Are there other medical conditions that can tie in and either make you more prone or just create more complications when you're at altitude?
If in general, we're talking about otherwise healthy people. So we're not talking about people with heart disease or lung disease. We're talking about healthy people. One of the things I would be cautious about, especially on a short trip, is going into the trip with an upper respiratory tract infection. So if you've got a cough and a cold, it would be the smartest thing in the world to take an extra day to acclimatize at a lower altitude. We think and have just seen anecdotally that people that have that kind of infection that's so common in the winter might be a little more susceptible to getting high-altitude pulmonary edema. The other thing, and I don't know the culture of hunters that well, but the culture of skiers and snowboarders, when we study them, it's amazing how much they drink when they first get to altitude. And I'm not talking about hydration. I'm talking about alcohol. And that is not a good thing. I'm not proselytizing against alcohol. I'm saying that in your one thing I really hope your listeners will take away from this is that those first hours and days of an altitude trip are really key. Your body is working hard to adjust. And the healthier you are in that period, the better things are going to be later. The problem with alcohol is that it suppresses your breathing when you sleep. If your breathing is lower when you sleep at high altitude, your oxygen level in your blood is going to be lower. And that's like being at a higher altitude. I know I'm confusing everybody with lower and higher, this and that. If your oxygen level is low, that's like being at a higher altitude. And And that means you're stressing your body more during that time. So lighten up on the alcohol and the first, and marijuana is the same way. It's a respiratory depressant and can have the same effects. Lighten up on any of that early in your trip, and the rest of the trip will be great. We did a study a decade or two ago now on veterans of the 10th Mountain Division, and we did it in Vail. And they arrived for a 5-day reunion, and they were supposed to come in and see us. We had 100 of them recruited. Youngest was 70, oldest was 92. And these guys, they're supposed to come in every morning and get checked out and then be on their own. First 2 days, they were there like clockwork, and some of them were there early and would stay late. Third morning, there were fewer. Fourth morning, fifth morning, there were, I mean, they were just trickling in. And so we started asking them about it, and they said, "Oh, man, we're not stupid. We all took it easy. Nobody went out to the bars the first two nights. You know, we all went to sleep at 8 o'clock and, you know, on and on." And he said, "But after the third day, we felt like we were free to party until the sun came up." And indeed they did, and suffered no ill effects. And that's based on just smart behavior when they first got to high altitude. And all your listeners could benefit from that, I'm sure.
What other things come to mind in terms of things to avoid, say, you know, a week before trip, days before trip, or the first days of a trip? And then after we talk about other things to potentially avoid, I want to talk about what we should be doing.
Yeah, there's nothing else on the big avoid list. I mean, you know, rest is key, because sleep is always a possibility that you won't sleep fantastic at altitude. So coming in exhausted to a trip like that isn't the greatest. Otherwise, I think you're fine. Unfortunately, so far, there's no way to predict who's going to get mountain sickness. Your best prediction is if you've had it before. If you've had a headache when you've been at altitude, you'll probably get one again. So then you can talk to your physician. I'm happy to send you an offline link to a paper of ours that you can give to your physician that outlines what drugs to use, and some of them are prescription. Ibuprofen works great for high-altitude headache, it looks like. There's another drug called Diamox that's a prescription drug. You can get that from your physician. And if you get mountain sickness regularly, it's probably worth trying it on a trip and seeing if it works for you. And those are the main things. And then there's a rescue med for high-altitude pulmonary edema that probably everybody should have in their kit. It's a prescription also called nifedipine or sildenafil. Can work also, but nifedipine is the most well studied, and it's a drug that if you start to get pulmonary edema, start to get severely short of breath, and your blood oxygen levels going down, will help you stabilize so you can get down to a lower altitude. So let's go through the symptoms. Mountain sickness we talked about is headache, dizziness, lightheadedness, and unusual fatigue, maybe some nausea and vomiting. Treatment for that is bed rest and plenty of fluids for a few days until you start to feel better. Ibuprofen for the headache. You can take some people take anti-nausea medications. High altitude pulmonary edema is you'll recognize it usually on the second night at a given altitude, and people start to have a radical change in their physical capacity is usually the first thing that we see. Most of us that go to altitude a lot always carry one of these $100 fingertip oximeters. And, you know, you get a group of guys or girls together, and everybody wants to know what everybody else's value is. And there's a little competition about who has the highest, and the not so smart ones will compete about who has the lowest, which isn't what you want. But you monitor that, and you'll notice that the same guy that has, you know, he was leading the group hiking the day before, and the next day he's dragging behind, feeling crappy, and his oxygen level's down. If that's the case, that usually happens because the most common cause would be that he's starting to get a little fluid in his lungs, and it's a reason to be extremely worried. Monitor them closely. And if they don't start to feel better soon, consider descending as fast as possible. And you don't have to descend a ton from 10,000 feet. If you go down to 8,000 feet, they'll probably feel a lot better, and with a day or two of rest, will be fully recovered. But remember that that is definitely not somebody you want to leave unattended. You don't want to leave them in a camp and go off for a couple of days, leaving them by themselves. The risk of them dying in their sleep from the pulmonary edema is very high. And so you want to be extremely cautious about that.
Would you have hoarse breathing, I guess? If somebody had, fluid in the lungs. So, I mean, if they breathe deep, do you kind of hear that raspiness, I guess?
You can. It isn't that easy to tell that they will experience, something when you're healthy, we have a hard time imagining what being short of breath is like, but it's really terrible. It's a horrible feeling when you can't catch your breath, and it's not exactly the same as being out of breath from exercising. It's just sitting there resting and being very short of breath. And that's probably the first thing that the HAPE patient will start experiencing. And if it doesn't go away with rest, then you've got a serious problem.
Yeah, that's good to know. It's interesting. I've always, heard of getting out of elevation, and I always pictured that as just like abandoned mission completely. But let's say there's a scenario where, your truck is parked at 8,000 feet. You've hiked in for a hunt a few miles, and now you're at 10.5. You start to have some of these symptoms. Maybe it's as simple as going back down to the truck and taking a day or two of rest and seeing how you feel. Not necessarily if you're on an out-of-state hunt, like just calling it quits completely and heading home.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And 9 times out of 10, you're going to feel much better, especially if the worst thing you can do is ignore symptoms. And it's something, I use my special forces friends as an example, because they are, nobody really will question if they're tough or not. But along with that toughness, that mental toughness comes, there's a gradation of, I can deny that my little finger hurts because that isn't going to stop me from doing what I have to do. But you go on and it's like, I can deny that, the wound to my shoulder hurts, but I can't really carry a pack. So what I'm trying to say is there's this training in knowing very specifically what you can tolerate and be safe, and what's not safe to tolerate. As civilians, we don't usually have that kind of training. And toughing your way through going to bed, being short of breath, and not telling your campmates, your hunting mates, your friends that are on the trip, you're putting everybody's life in danger. Let's say you hiked and didn't have four-wheelers, and you're at 10.5, and a blizzard comes in, and you can't walk in the morning, but you need to go down. That's where the trouble for your friends comes in. And it's a blizzard, and you got 3 feet of new snow, and they have to carry you, and there's, that's incredibly hard in the best of conditions. And in this condition that the scenario we're talking about can be really, really hard. And people have had whole groups get in serious trouble because of one person who didn't tell everybody what was going on. Because of that, we encourage everybody from special forces operators to civilians climbing or hunting or hiking in the backcountry to believe in the buddy system and put machoism and pride and all that crap aside, and every night and every morning check in with your buddy about how you're doing and take it seriously. And it just plain leads to better health for everybody and much, much less risk.
Is there, I know I've seen pills, vitamins, supplements out there advertised as helping with, altitude sickness or adjusting to elevation. Is there any validity to those?
It's pretty amazing when you go, I don't know where you've seen it, Steve, but if you go into the King Supers, or what do they call it, City Market in Breckenridge, There's a whole rack of stuff that does nothing. and these companies always approach us and say, oh, we'd like to study this. And we tell them what it would cost and say, well, we don't really want to study it that much. And the thing is, you guys know this from your lives, having nothing to do with altitude, but you know how for heart disease, there's a new drug that works on the first 100 people they try it on, and then they try it on 1,000, and they have mixed, some diversity of races, and they have men and women and this and that, and it doesn't work on 3/4 of them. And that's just human biology. That's how complicated our bodies are and how different our reactions are. So these untested things that they sell, including oxygen, oxygen's great. I love oxygen, but oxygen's only good when you're breathing the extra oxygen. You go off of it, you're right back where you were, and you're no better off. You simply are kind of craving that fix of breathing oxygen. So there's a bar, or used to be a bar in Breckenridge, where you could, sidle up to the bar and for 15 minutes breathe, lavender scented oxygen. And for 15 minutes, you probably feel better. I mean, no doubt about it. It has no lasting effects. It isn't going to cure you. It isn't going to fix, anything. And all those over the counter things, I'm sorry to say, I have nothing against over the counter things. I don't work for the drug companies. I'd love it if there was an over the counter medicine that worked great. None of them work. And it's unfortunate, but that's just the truth. So I started out in the Northwest. There was a guy peddling Rolaids for climbers on Mount Rainier. He wrote a little book about it, and because of his business, he had kind of a big voice in the climbing community. And we were pretty sure that there's no sense to the idea even behind what he was saying. But it took me, I got a grant from the National Science Foundation, and we spent 2 summers taking climbers up Mount Rainier and, not telling them if they were getting Rolaids or if they were getting placebo. And we proved there was no effect at all of the Rolaids. But it's a huge amount of effort that it takes to do those studies. And so these companies don't do it and know that they can just peddle things and nobody's really watching. As long as they don't kill anybody in the process, they get away with it.
I don't think we kind of covered this. Is there an elevation that things all of a sudden exponentially get worse? I mean, where you really need to start paying attention, say, at 10,000 feet, 90% of the people are good, but all of a sudden you get to 12.5 and that ratio starts going up substantially higher?
Yeah, that's a good question. It is something. There are some people, surprisingly, that 5,000 feet affects them. But that's on the rare end of this bell-shaped curve. And then you go up and more people. I would say 10,000 feet is certainly a kind of a hallmark. There are many people that notice 10,000 feet. 12,000 feet is, another one. I mean, it's really gradual. 14,000 feet is definitely a place where a huge number of people, what I say, 70% or so, if they go up from sea level to 14,000 feet in a few hours, 70% of people will get mountain sickness.
Oh, right. Okay.
So it's kind of gradual. In my mind, with years of experience, I think of 10,000 feet as being the first big cutoff. And then somewhere around 14 to 18 as being the next big cutoffs. Those are high altitudes. Above 18,000 feet is really high and you need to be really careful.
Okay.
But that's rare for your readers to ever go that high. 14,000
yeah.
feet still takes a lot of consideration. You wouldn't take it lightly, even though you could fly into Denver and drive down to Colorado Springs and drive to the top of Pikes Peak or Mount Evans. If you spent the night there for a couple nights, you'd have some very sick people, guaranteed.
Mm. Yeah, no, I said for me, I don't think, Boise is 2,700 feet, and I don't think twice about driving 3 hours and getting up at 10,000 feet, but I haven't spent a lot of time probably above 12. So it's kind of if I was going to go mule deer hunting in Colorado at 13, do I really need to pay attention to that?
I'd say yes. I'd say you really do. And anything above 10, you want to start thinking, what's my accommodation schedule? How many days can I afford to, you know, be? And we talked about 9,000 feet being a nice altitude. That's great. Mm-hmm. Breckenridge is 9,300 feet. A lot of those hotels, 9,500 feet. Those are all great intermediate stopping places. The other thing we didn't talk about is, if you have time, a great thing to do is to, so let's take your drive from the Midwest or even from the coast, the West Coast or East Coast, and you arrive in Colorado. You spend the night at 9,000 feet. If you can fit it in your calendar, the next day, drive up to Mount Evans or any of the other drives where you can get to 14,000 feet and hike around, go on a long hike up there, and then go back to 9,000 feet and sleep. That up and down, climb high, sleep low, is the saying we use in mountaineering. What we think happens is you kind of stimulate your body more severely than just staying at 9,000 feet. And then you go back and recover and rest at a lower altitude. And that the body likes that a lot and will reward you with being more adjusted when you go back the next day.
That's a great, just plan your route to go over 14,000 feet, get out of the car, hike around, and then, yeah that's a great, great strategy.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it can be fun, you know? I mean, I'm a little older and starting to, you know, I try to do as much as everybody else does in a short amount of time, but I'm also getting to the point where it's like, wait a minute, do I really want to miss this, you know, great city that I, or town or, you know, natural site that's nearby because I'm in a hurry to go, you know, do what I'm supposed to do there. And what if I did take that detour and took a day and acclimatized a little bit? How much more would I enjoy the main thing I'm coming to do? So it's a little anti-modern lifestyle advice to, you know, really value your time and know that this is one of the great things about altitude is it can't be rushed. And and for your readers to think about that and say, okay, I'm going to do this, but I'm not going to be an idiot and fly into Vail and drive up to 14,000 feet and hike there for 4 days and then fly home. I'm going to take a couple of days and do some hikes. I mean, all of these mountain towns, I know Breckenridge the best, but, you know, Vail's the same way. You can go there, eat great food in restaurants, have a really nice hotel or motel, and hike to 12, 13, 14,000 feet and have beautiful views. I like to cycle for exercise, great bicycle riding. And so you can, and all that time while you're having fun, you're acclimatizing. And that's going to mean you can carry more, you can hike farther and do all of it safer than if you're unacclimatized.
This probably leads us kind of back to that discussion that Steve asked about of kind of the over-the-counter natural supplements and things like that. But another thing that popped into my mind, semi-related, that people do kind of prepare, supposedly, is there's these things out there called elevation training masks, which, to my understanding, just basically restrict airflow while you train or do some sort of physical activity that's supposed to simulate doing that activity at altitude. Is there any validity to that? And is that any sort of valid way to train or, you know, get acclimated before you are at elevation?
There's no evidence from the limited studies that have been done that this kind of short term, you know, working out in the gym, that's one way it's peddled a lot, and breathing low oxygen for a few minutes. There's something about this response that I've been telling you about that needs hours of a pretty strong dose. And by hours, I mean 12 hours or more to start the process. And so a half an hour in the gym, breathing one of those things, or the mask, I forget, some Seahawks use that mask. I remember seeing it in an ad, and those kinds of things aren't... They may change your perception of breathing and have some other effects, but they don't directly impact how you'll do at high altitude.
What about training in heat? I know that I've seen some things in the past that talked about the physical demands of training in high heat are somewhat similar to the physiological response of being at elevation, just in terms of demands on a body. Is there any link there?
You know, it's interesting that you asked that. There's a theory that our bodies have a general response to stress. And within that theory, the heat scientists say, and I know that the Army is testing this right now, that if you get acclimated to heat, that that's going to cross over and be an advantage to when you go to high altitude. The science is behind that idea, behind meaning it hasn't caught up to that idea yet, but there's nothing to say that it might not work. It hasn't been disproven, and I think it's kind of an attractive idea that we would have this general, you know, threat response, stress response that is able to help with all kinds of challenges, heat, cold, you know, infection, you can imagine, and altitude. So I'd say the jury's out on that, but it looks interesting for the future.
You mentioned previously prescriptions like Diamax. When should someone consider that? Is it just based off of previous experience of getting sick, or should someone maybe going on their first big high mountain hunt be thinking about or talking to their doctor about some sort of prescription?
So one interesting thing about Diamox is you can take it as you've developed mountain sickness. It works as a treatment. I personally advocate learning how your body adjusts to anything, and altitude in particular. Make that part of not something to be scared of, but, you know, we talk to our kids about how important it is to know the effects of alcohol on the body. Right? You don't want your kids to leave home and have no idea how this thing affects them and make some mistakes later in life. And altitude is the same way. Knowing about it, knowing how you, I mean, just between the two of you, we've heard different responses and different, you know, severity of the response and probably a little different altitude profile. That's really, really important to know. And everybody's different. I've been shocked when I've gotten some of my special operators into the lab and they're being deployed to high altitude regions all over the world and they've never been out of Kentucky. I'm exaggerating, but they've never been to high altitude. And it's so different and so unique to each individual. I argue, don't take medicine the first time. Have it, know about it, know what to look for, and plan your first trip so you can stay out of trouble. And then if you get bad mountain sickness, definitely you can look for the preventive guidelines that we and others have written about that you can use. And they're all kinds, and there's still being studies. There's a study this summer to see if the day that you go to altitude, so not during your drive from Missouri, do you take the Diamox, but you just wait until you get to 9,000 or 10,000 feet and then you start it. And then can you take a really low dose of it? And so there's still lots of research going on, and I'd encourage your readers just to watch the news for new ideas about Diamox. But it's a very dependable drug and one that can both treat and prevent mountain sickness.
Perfect. Robert, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Robert. Yeah, you bet. Super informative. Hey.